Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy McPoor. Today we bring you the next program in our series of talks on foreign affairs at the 2018 Champlain Institute, hosted by College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor. We are joining Fred Benson in conversation with former U.S. Navy Admiral Jonathan Greenert, who will discuss 21st century security issues across the world and how they've changed under the Trump administration. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and you can find this program on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. And you can find this program as a podcast. And now, here's today's host, Fred Benson.
Admiral Greenert, it is indeed an honor to be sitting next to you, but I have to tell you something. The last time I sat next to an admiral, just more than a year ago, he leaned over to me and said, Fred, don't you think it's interesting that all of the military services tell time differently? And I said, how so? He said, well, the Air Force uses the 24-hour clock, so 3 p.m. is 1,500 hours. The Navy, he said, 3 p.m. is 6 bells. Then, in a loud voice, so everyone around the table could hear, he said, now the Army, it's the big hand on 12 and the little hand on the 3.
I had nothing to do with that. All right.
It was a different admiral. Thank you, Admiral, so much for being here. And I want to thank you, too, for your 40 years. Can you imagine the commitment of 40 years of active duty military with family separations, combat tours, 24/7 operation in the Pentagon? This man has made an incredible contribution to our country, to the Navy, especially his 4 years as the CNO.
Thank you.
I'd like to put a fine point on that job. The Navy is a huge organization. When you add all of the active duty sailors, plus the reserves, plus about 200,000 civilian employees, it totals about 562,000 people in the Navy. Move that to the corporate world. The Navy is in size second only to Walmart. It is a huge organization. Leading that Navy is a huge responsibility. Okay, here we go. We have agreed and discussed over the last several weeks that we face a myriad of challenges to our national security, both at home and abroad. Let's start at home. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats has warned Congress that, quote, the U.S. government's increasingly fractious political process, particularly with respect to federal funding, is threatening our ability to defend our nation, both in the short term and especially in the long term. How does one manage an organization the size of the Navy with such uncertain funding circumstances?
Well, simply put, you don't do it all that well with these sort of circumstances. Very choppy, going from year to year, wondering about that. But before I start, may I first say thank you for doing all this research, getting into these hopefully interesting questions. And to tell the audience, I think today we're going to shift from bewilderment yesterday to anger, frustration, and resolve. That's where we'll be at the end of all of this when I'm done with you, all right? And I want to thank President Collins. Thank you so much for inviting me and Lynn and Amanda for being wonderful, providing wonderful hospitality. I think Director Coats was talking about three things in this regard. Number one, we have existential, or let's say external threats to the nation. I would say none of them at this time are existential, which means they have the capability to truly threaten the nation and its overall well-being and the intent. So, and that includes China and Russia, which are probably in the top two tier. And then you have Iran and North Korea. Now, some would argue North Korea's capability. And then you have under all of that ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and I'll just say violent extremism. So he's saying in this, with this in mind and with the length of this, we have two other internal problems. And I would categorize the number one as lack of regular order in the legislative branch and to a certain extent in the executive branch. And number two, we're not dealing with the deficit and the instruments of that. And it's going to be a real problem, especially entitlements. So regular order, what is he talking about? Well, over the last decade and a half, we've had what's called, when our federal budget comes out, especially for the Department of Defense and actually all of the national security associated agencies, so that's Department of Justice, Department of Treasury, and certainly Department of Homeland Security and the DOD. Those budgets come late in the year. And when you reach October the 1st, the beginning of the fiscal year, we're on what's called a continuing resolution. People say, well, what is that? Well, it's you resolve to continue. But you're continuing nothing more than really payroll, operations, and standard processes and contracts from the previous year that carry over. You can't start new things. You can't build new sensors, new weapons, new tanks, new airplanes, new ships. You cannot put those under contract until you get a new budget, and that's by law. You are resolved to continue. And these have extended 3, 4, 5 months, again, many times over 15 years. That makes it very difficult to predict, to have a reliable budget, and it isn't really necessarily the size of the budget, it's to have it on time so you can get started to recruit, to retain, to work with our contractors, our big contractors, to build ships and do the other things. They turn to us, the Department of Defense, actually, again, all these security departments, the industry, and they say, so tell me, how do I adjust my workforce? Where are we going? And you kind of have to say, I'm not sure. I don't have a budget. I don't have a long-term vision, an agreement like this. Under this plan, or under this process, under this situation, is the Budget Control Act of 2011. That is a 10-year-long Budget Act installed in 2011. The reason was, you might recall, we were reaching our debt ceiling, we the United States and the federal government, and we had a choice. We need to extend the ceiling or figure out a way to reduce the budget in the future, our spending. So Congress could reach that agreement with the executive branch in that time frame. So the agreement was we will raise the ceiling so that we don't default as a federal government. And then we will, over the next 10 years, we'll reduce the federal budget, $600 billion, and those were inserted. And we will create a super committee, which got, you might remember those, a bipartisan committee. You all go together and figure out a way to reduce $1.5 trillion out of the federal budget over the next 10 years, starting in 2011. If you fail to do this, then the federal budget will be reduced if it ever exceeds caps. You will be brought down to those caps, and those caps will reduce the budget over 10 years, $1.2 trillion. The whole idea was to get a handle on this and to put in place this draconian reduction that would include every single program. Everything comes down. $600 billion domestic, $600 billion. Let me call it, it's not really domestic, it's discretionary and mandatory programs. So that's this, they said, super committee, do your work. They were unable to come to an agreement. So we entered what we call sequestration. And we had budget caps, and these reductions were pushed out into the later of the 10 years. And so my point in all of this is that as our needs were laid together, and this is the entire federal budget, they continued to exceed the caps that were put in place. And we said, well, what are we going to do? And so we worked our way through kind of herky-jerky in this, making last-minute deals. They called them bipartisan budget agreements, 2 years at a time. We're under one right now. And you take this pause, and you go above the caps because you agree to go above these caps, and you allow the federal government to continue to operate and in a reasonable manner. It doesn't really, none of the departments in the government got what they say they need to carry out their jobs, if you will, but it was better than this sequestration, these caps down here. And this is, again, in domestic and in discretionary programs, mainly defense, carry that. So where are we now? Well, we're all the way to 2018, and we have been, if you will, sequestered. We've been subject to, at the start of the fiscal year, and the start of the calendar year, I'm sorry, all of a sudden, all your programs are reduced a certain amount, every single one. Now, that includes payroll, and you might remember we furloughed federal employees, and we're still hurting from that. All of this is a lack of regular order of putting a budget together, having it ready on the 1st of October, predictability, reliability, a long-term vision for that. which frankly we had for decades. And it just sort of went off track in the late 90s and has carried its way helter-skelter through this. So that's kind of number two, this lack of regular order. It's exacerbated in the operation of the federal government by the lack of leadership being nominated and confirmed by the Senate. Now, we've seen this in the paper time and again, but we're still way behind. And so I think if had we asked Mr. Blinken yesterday, tell us about the State Department when you left and how it is now, he'd say there are several assistant secretaries, undersecretaries, people that get the job done while the secretary and the deputy are doing the, you know, the legwork and out the external work. That's a lack of regular order. Back to the deficit. The federal government and its the pressure on the deficit is really dominated by entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And according to a Congressional Budget Act study, in 2000, 60 cents of all of our tax dollars went to entitlements, to these big three programs and interest on the federal debt. In 2016, that was 80 cents of our tax dollars going to these entitlements. The prediction is by 2030, all of it will go, all of our tax money will go to paying these entitlements and our interest, and we will basically be borrowing to do non-discretionary programs. Well, what are they? They are defense, they are treasury, they are justice, they are homeland security, education. So if you say, we need to fix the problems of this country, we need to fix our defense, we have an opioid problem and a drug problem, we have education issues, you get my point, law enforcement, those are all on that end of this scale of the budget. The entitlements will grow. Our population is aging. Today, roughly 1 in 7 are over 65. By 2020, it'll be 1 in 5. So these vectors are going in the wrong direction. We need to address, and this is what Director Coates is saying. Hey, he just left the Senate, you might recall. We need to address these deficit issues. We need to address entitlement, get on with entitlement reform, and it doesn't take dramatic things. You don't have to eliminate Social Security. You could raise the age a few years. You could do some things here and there, and the same with Medicare, and you could get just hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. The size of that entitlement program is so large that it can be resolved. We just need to buckle down and get after that. Those are the three things he's talking about.
I think your comments will generate a number of questions during the question period. Thank you for that overview. Let's go overseas a minute. In 2011, President Trump, arguing that we had not placed sufficient priority on Asia, directed a pivot or a relocation to Asia, involving a number of military issues. And how did that work out? Did we do it? Did we do it right? You were commanding the 7th Fleet at the time, I think.
Yeah, at the beginning. Well, actually, this was President Obama, so I was in the Pentagon then. But I had command of the 7th Fleet, and I have a lot of experience out there. So in my opinion, of course, with that as a background, I thought it was the right thing to do. But I think most of the nation felt it was right. We were in the Middle East. We were consumed with the Middle East for a long time, over a decade, actually. In fact, longer than that. And things were looking, in his view, and I think he was right, stable, or somewhat stable. And we needed to get to where most of our future resides. Most of the growing economies are out there. The largest economies are out there. 4 of the 6 of our defense treaties are out there. It goes on. And you have China. And his point is, we need to decide, what are we going to do here? So to your question, I would say we started out very well. It has to be a whole-of-government approach, and that was his intention. You might recall Secretary Clinton announced it, and she was working with Secretary Gates at the time, and then eventually Secretary Panetta, and they were very much in synchronization on how we were going to do that, do this pivot, which became rebalance. You know, you pick the word. Words have become important, of course. And so that's where this started off in the right foot. We in the Department of Defense were required to provide our programs down to the service level. I was asked as the Chief of the Navy, so what are you going to do to rebalance the Navy toward the Asia-Pacific region? And we said, all right, Today, we have 100, at that time, we had 100 ships on deployment. 50 are in the Asia Pacific. We will migrate that to 60 at any given time. So deployments will increase, and our presence out there will increase. Number two, we'll increase the forces that we have in the Asia Pacific. We'll move a few more ships to Japan. We need to talk to them about that. We'll look for what we'll call places, not bases. Bases are only on sovereign territory, so we call them sort of places. In Singapore, in Malaysia, and some in Philippines. We'll look to go back into the Philippines and see if they will give us just access so that we can have access to different places and be able to respond faster. We'll move our most capable equipment out there. As soon as it's ready to deploy, it's going to the Asia Pacific. And what I'll call intellectual capital, we'll spend more time out there. I will get on a plane and go out there and talk to my counterparts more. I will kind of skew my interface with my counterparts, and that goes across the services out there. The Army stood up a 4-star command called Army Pacific, used to be a 3-star command, and the Air Force did things accordingly. So we were off on the right foot, I think. And then Syria happened, actually ISIS happened, and in Iraq. We left Iraq in 2011, you might remember, the things started kind of coming apart. ISIS emerged, then we have this caliphate starting to take effect, and attention moved over there. So we kind of got bogged down in this whole of government. The approach in a whole of government, we in security say, think of the term DIME, like dime. You have to have a diplomatic aspect, an information aspect. You have to make it clear to all of your constituents and those you interface with. In this case, it would have been China and others. You have to have an M, a military aspect, and an economic aspect. And we really didn't get going, we got the M going sort of right away. That led China and others to say, hey, what are you doing? Well, you're militarizing this thing. What do you guys got up your sleeve? And I said, oh, no, this is just a simple rebalance. And they said, I don't know anything about this rebalance. We said, well, surely, don't you read the paper or, you know, the media? And they said, well, I heard about it, but what is it? And so it got in a little bit of a kerfuffle, as we like to say out there, and we were explaining what it was. The State Department was doing their best, but their secretary was back to the Mideast doing other things. Soon the Iran deal started moving. It was very difficult to get a whole of government focus there. Eventually, TPP came forward as sort of the diplomatic economic point. Secretary Kerry spent time and got going a deal with the Philippines to get access. But we just sort of got into a little bit of fits and starts. This administration came in and they said, forget the pivot, that's the last administration. So we have an E element of this. We have a little bit of an I element, information, and we're talking about what we're going to do economically in the Asia Pacific and what we're not going to do. We need to get the M back up, you know what I mean, and get back to this balanced approach on what are we going to do in the Asia Pacific. Okay. So I happen to be finishing an article that we put together at the National Bureau for Asian Research. And it's sort of an idea or a lay down of what we think are the key tenets for an Asia-Pacific campaign. We have a strategy to go out there. But what do you do at the key countries? Who are the key countries and how do you approach them? We believe the key countries are 7. They are Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, India, and Indonesia. And I didn't count that. I think that's 7. But each of those are different in their own right. And we measure them by their national power, all right? Not national resources necessarily, but national power. And that is the ability to take your national resources together and apply them. In a way, and it could be economic, could be major economic, it could be your population and the great potential you have, and that kind of takes you to Indonesia. But they have less military. So it's kind of a summation of that. So that's number one, the national power. Number two, what is their cultural strategy? The Indonesians look at things different than the Chinese, than the Indians, than the Japanese. So you need to understand the culture, and if you take those two elements, what is the likelihood of them to apply this national power? What would be their national strategy? And you really want to have a campaign plan which resonates with that. Or you might be asking Japan to do something or trying to coerce them to do something that's really not in their culture and that's not in their national plan at all. And you walk your way through all that. So I think the rebalance, I believe we need to do it. We call it whatever you want. We need to face that way. We need to get going. It needs to be whole of government, balanced across. North Asia is different from South Asia, and it's called Indo-Pacific now, as right. you know, recognizing right. the two oceans and those that border it. But it needs to be balanced, organized, and we need to inform them what our intentions are. Because you get behind that eight ball, it is very hard to catch up.
Okay, thank you. Back home again, Secretary of Defense Mattis firmly stated the following, and I quote, climate change can be a driver of instability, and the Department of Defense must pay attention to the potential adverse impacts generated by this phenomenon, end quote. The Naval Station at Norfolk, Virginia already floods 10 times per year. Mm-hmm. The sea level at the base has risen 15 inches. Are we going to have to build dikes around coastal military facilities?
Well, we might. So what is your belief in climate change? That can be in capital letters because that defines something, or the climate's changing, small caps or small letters, whichever you want to do. But there's at least an evolution going on. Let me say that we're studying all of our bases, the possibilities, the rise that's taking place. I live in Annapolis, the center of the city, if some of you may have been there. Called City Dock, and that's where people pull their boats in, and people have big boats, they park their boats on Ego Alley, which is right down a couple
Alley.
Of piers. That's where the big ones go. But the point is, the City Dock, based on the phase of the moon, the tidal surge, and weather, and if it rained a lot, when it got in sync, you would get flooding down there, up over the piers, if you will, and some of the street, maybe five times a year. Now, we get it a couple times a month, easily. So what are we doing? First, our issue, the biggest issue with the Navy and the Coast Guard, is the Arctic. And we've looked at the Arctic. My time in the Navy, I got our best oceanographic minds, and we said, when is the Arctic passable? And they said somewhere around 2022 to 2026. What does passable mean? Well, that means that you can routinely, not through slushy ice or pieces of ice here or there, because that would mean it's dangerous, and they won't risk container ships. That means you can pass through all the way from the Bering Sea, you know, into Europe. Okay, are there any threats up there? No, not really at this time. Nobody is. There's not a troll under the bridge threatening all that. Are there territorial disputes? Yes. Is there a way to solve them? Yes. There's an Arctic Council, which Russia and China and we are a part of, and we were just the chair of that council, and it does solve issues and has solved territorial issues. We talked to Maersk and a few other folks and said, so, do you plan to use the Arctic in 10 years? And they said, maybe. Well, what do you mean, maybe? And they said, well, first of all, the weather up there is fairly unpredictable, and it's getting more unpredictable. And we need to understand what we're getting into up there before we send a ship up there, and we're into storms, fog, whatever, and we lose anything we try to gain by taking a shortcut. That's number one. Number two, we need to be able to pass through there reliably. The most important thing to a shipping company is not being there fast, but being there on time. When you say, I'll have the containers there, they can be trained off or trucked off, that's most important. So we are looking at that very closely. We, the Navy and the Coast Guard, actually all the services, the equipment that we build, the way we do operations, we have to think in an Arctic sense. Think cold weather. Think the effect on what is the satellite termination footprint up there? Because we didn't plan to operate there other than under the ice. So if we're going to be above the ice, if you will, do we have any satellite terminations so that we can communicate, get weather, get navigation, all that? These are all under review right now, Fred, and moving along. Lastly, I would say we had a series of natural disasters, especially in the Ring of Fire area of the Pacific, you know, up South America through Indonesia and all the way around to Japan. That was kind of unnerving, and we were watching and we said, you know, if this is the new normal, this is going to be an impact of a changing or evolving climate. And we need to understand and prepare ourselves to have to assist a lot more nations than we were in the past. That is at, I don't know, it's a pause, or maybe it isn't changing like we thought, but we need to keep our eye on that. Some of the typhoons out there have been more severe than in this last 7 years than previous decades. But we're keeping an eye on that. I wouldn't make any conclusions on that. And lastly, I'd say if you want to read about something that we talked, the ambassadors talked about it yesterday, and Mr. Blinken referred to it, which is the impact of the climate on immigration and other things. Thomas Friedman wrote a really good book a few years ago called Thank You for Being Late. I don't know if any of you have read that, but if you go into that and you remember, he talked about how the Syrian war started and who are these rebels and how did this all come about. And it frankly started with a change in the climate, which caused basically a drought in Syria, which caused the farmers to go broke. They went into the city. There's no work. They're joined by engineers who used to service the farmers and all that. And you've got a lot of fairly educated, skilled people who are stuck in the city, and you know, the leadership left them alone and resisted them, and it turned into a war. Well, a lot of the folks in Africa are really escaping drought. They're escaping things due to an evolution in climate. And I would say we collectively need to keep our eye on that and not just say, well, and not be just reacting to something, but see, are we in fact having a change in here, and can we help them help themselves to escape this problem?
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. We're at the 2018 Champlain Institute, where Admiral Jonathan Greenert is discussing security and defense across the globe.
Another big topic we talked about is cyber. Nick Dowling earlier this week reminded us of the importance and the growing intensity of cyber warfare. I would ask, can the government do more with the private sector to link in their cyber defense? And further, when or are we unleashing our offensive cyber capability to undermine the efforts of those countries who are trying to undermine us?
I'll go to the last question first. We are. And I'll call it offensive cyber from the perspective of we are not just exploiting, we are not just monitoring, defending, but we are not openly advertising, nor are we declaring that we have offensive capability and offensive campaigns. But we have the capability. The question becomes, and it gets back to, frankly, you go back to Snowden and that release of classified material, which was skewed, heavily classified material, which was skewed and got people wrapped up in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Your government is spying on you, and it mixed up Cyber Command, which is really the nation's defense right now, subject to other agencies, Homeland Security and all the other departments, having their own cyber defense. It really resides in there. And you're linked together with the National Security Agency, Cyber Command, and that's the same agency that does a lot of major intelligence, looks into circuits, looks into communications. And the public is saying, I'm not comfortable with how my privacy is being dealt with. You have the issue of the San Bernardino murders, and you have the federal government looking for a phone, and you have Apple saying, I'm not ready. So there's a suspicion here that needs to be reconciled and worked through. I think it can be done, especially if it's for the sake of our national security. I think the federal government can work with private industry, but they're both going to have to put down some elements of their shielding and the things that preclude them from doing that. But we're not there yet, but the means are there. Okay. I think we'll have to get there. The Secretary of Homeland Security said they have stood up a center which will monitor and deal with crises involving critical infrastructure, electrical grid, and some of our very sensitive federal services. That's very important, I think, because now we're not so fractured in the federal government. Bring that together, stand up and say, I'm in charge here. Work with DOD to make sure that's clear, and then turn to industry with a coherent, cogent plan to get on with this.
Okay. The U.S. has been at war for almost 17 years, with varying degrees of involvement and intensity. What has been the effect on the Navy of this very continuous deployment schedule, specifically recruitment, retention, morale, maintenance of ships and weapons? Is the Navy in top fighting form?
Well, I think if you go back maybe 17 years ago when we got started on this, it becomes the 9/11 business, and President declared war on terror. but we never officially declared war. He received the authorization to use military force from the Congress, and they presented an act that said, you can do this, you can use military force for countering terrorism. And so my point is, we never really declared war. We don't have a wartime budget, and the things that trigger into that, we have a what we call a base budget in the Department of Defense and the other departments, and we have this thing that's called overseas contingency operations. And I'm turning to the budget because it's sort of a microcosm of how that gets into operations. My point is, we're sort of not admitting we're at war. Maybe we're not. Maybe this is the new normal. We talked about this yesterday. We're committed to places around the world, and it's calmed down some. But we're definitely doing operations greater than the base operations that our strategy declares we'll do. What that means is we're asking the military and the Department of State and others, and really all of the Department of Defense, to conduct operations which really exceed the national strategy that we have day in and day out. When you break it down to how much time are you at sea, how much are you flying, where are your brigade combat teams out there deployed around the world? And they say, well, don't worry about this. We'll fund this with this supplemental funding, overseas contingency operations. They're not subject to caps, which opens the door for kind of cheating if you're a true, you know, financial zealot, if you will, on how you should spend the federal government. You're shifting things over to overseas contingency operations. So we are carrying out the need that the president declares needs to happen around the world, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, the you know, ISIS, and those sorts of things, what we're doing in the Pacific, the rebalance of the Pacific, really without a declaration of war and the budgetary background for that. You get an imbalance. Your operational tempo is higher than you plan for on the routine. We in the Department of Defense have had this discussion where we say, put it in the strategy and do things the way, and declare in our strategy, we're going to do things that way. Congress said no. To do that, you need an authorization to use military force. It has to follow straight through your budget, and it has to follow straight through your policies. So we have this dichotomy here. That sets the situation. How's morale? Morale is good. Morale has been good really since 2001. The 9/11 folks that joined the military and said, my country is under attack, I need to do my time to support it. Many of them have left. It's been 17 years. Many of the combat operations have migrated down to a lower term. But there are clearly operations going on, as I said, greater than normal. But folks feel they have a clear mission, and they have a clear, and the country supports them. We mentioned this yesterday, and I think it's extraordinary. Somebody who's been in the military, was in the military a long time, since the Cold War, it is extraordinary the support that our citizens provide our military. I see it every time I go travel, and every year, the thank you for the service. That is a shot of adrenaline for 6 weeks to a service member. And we say, well, we're gonna give you more money, and what Billy and Susie want, they want to be appreciated for what they're doing, and they have their own Marines. Recruiting is becoming a little more difficult. We have a lot of people that want to join, but out of a given graduating high school class, 1 in 3 are not even qualified to join the military, are all-volunteer force. They either don't have the academic aptitude, they don't medically qualify, they have a record of some sort or a psychological disorder of some sort. And some say, well, you all need to fix that. I mean, come on. And you say, you really want us to lower the standards? We won't do it. We're meeting our goals, and the Department of Defense is meeting the goals. It becomes harder for cyber warriors. It becomes harder for people that do electronics, for people, SEALs, very difficult. You need people to get clearance. You have to have the attributes to get a clearance. And that's becoming harder. So recruiting is getting harder, but we're making it. We need to open the aperture to new immigrants. We need to be more diverse, more gender diversity. We have about 20%. We probably need 30% females in our military, in my opinion, and that's what the service chief's goals are. And, of course, minorities. You know, cultural diversity is great. It brings you all kind of new ideas, and we talked about that yesterday, too, and how that works in companies as well. Retention is good, except in some areas. Pilots, which cost a lot of money to train. Airlines are hiring. There are, as they say, you can't swing a dead cat around a Southwest waiting area without finding a former military person in the pilot's seat, you know? And it's just that way. Nuclear-trained people, there are a lot of jobs still in the nuclear industry. It goes on. Highly skilled people and cyber people make big money, security people. So retaining them is important in that regard. And then lastly, readiness. These issues that we talked in the first question have been fairly debilitating to maintaining the readiness of the force that is doing this increased op tempo. Mm-hmm. And when you are late getting a budget, 3 months or 4 months, and that happens 5 years in a row, 4 times 5 is 20 months, that's almost 2 years, you start falling behind in upgrading your ships, modernizing, bringing higher technology in, and it starts to become a real problem. Each year, they say, I'm only 3 months late, 4 months, and I gave you more money than you asked. You should be happy. And you say, well, thank you very much for that, but I can't get that money spent in the remaining months of the year. I have to have it obligated in that fiscal year. So right now, for example, here we are in August. We got August, September. The budget came in June-ish, I think it was, and people are scrambling in 2018 to get a fairly substantial amount of money obligated and under contract. And we're turning to our partners in the industry and saying, come on, chop, 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 I need to get this stuff going. And they say, well, first of all, we had this discussion about my workforce and you were not able to give me much, so I'll hire up as fast as I can. You're gonna pay a premium because I've got to bring people in overtime just to write the contracts. So it gets very, we're not very good partners in all this and we're not really in sync. So this has been, I guess in general, we have a little bit of an imbalance in our strategy and what we want our military force to do. Mm-hmm. And I think you either need to, if you say this is the strategy, this is what we want, you need to take a hard look at how the size of the military you want and how you want to fund it. The answer from the military, honestly, Fred, is not, we just need a bigger military. Is, if you want me to do all this, we need a bigger military, or we're not going to be as good as you want us and you demand us to be, and we're worried about that.
Okay. I do have one related, short related question, and then I would like to ask the Admiral to tell a story about when he was a young officer being aboard a submarine that was taking water. So if we could cover this question quickly and move
sure.
into that. Estimates are that 170,000 of our 1.3 million military people are serving active duty assignments in 160 countries around the world. Mm-hmm. Is this an essential deployment, and is it sustainable?
I don't think it's sustainable for the reason I just described. It is essential for the wants and needs of our nation today. We talked about it yesterday. Since World War II, we were the major power. We have commitments to NATO, South Korea, Japan. We have commitments in the Middle East. We've been in Bahrain for 75 years. Maybe people didn't realize that. They've been partners. So I was thinking yesterday, and I cannot remember recently, a successful operation that we did involving global security somewhere where we were able to say, everything looks good here, we're going home. And if we did, we ended up coming back in maybe larger numbers. So that's the world we live in today for the strategy, for the what we want and what we view our function to be globally, and to maintain a global economy the way we want it and need it in security. Okay. Or allies need to do more, and that's a whole nother kettle of fish.
I think we've heard that before.
Yeah.
Please tell us about that day on the sub.
Sure. So what Fred's referring to is I gave a TED talk a number of years ago, about 4 years ago, I think it was, and I was asked to come in and speak to about accountability and about second chances. And the venue was the Western Pennsylvania Penitentiary. So I don't know if you've ever seen or done a TED talk, you have to tell a story. So they said, come and tell a story about accountability and second chances, and you have to do it in about 10 minutes. It's a very interesting regimented process. But again, I'm in a penitentiary doing this, so maybe that corner of the audience is all in orange, all right? And then we had a lot of parole officers and security people, and then over here, a lot of their audience. And it goes something like this. Back in 1977, we almost sunk a nuclear submarine by the pier. We have lost two submarines in the history of the submarine, the nuclear submarine force. They were due to new construction problems and that. But one of the most vulnerable periods in a submarine's life, if you will, is being pier side with maintenance going on. If you put the submarine or any ship in dry dock, you can go in and take valves off, covers, and you can take the shaft off. And you're all familiar with that if you have a boat. But dry docks, there are not many of them, so you have to do this work pier side. So it requires extreme vigilance and care. In this particular circumstance, this nuclear submarine was getting maintenance done, and they needed to take inside the hull, they needed to take some valves apart, and these were seawater valves, so suction and discharge. They were going to take apart the discharge valve. But when you do that, you need to put something on the outside to keep the water out of the people tank. And so divers come down, and they are here to put up what's called a flange. And it's about the size of a pizza pan, 12-inch pizza pan. And you put it on there, and there are holes in the hull put there, and they bolt that thing on. So they come in, they come down to do that. They will bring the paperwork up, and they'll go to the officer in charge on that day of the ship, and they say, our work here is done. Please sign for this. We've put this flange on. So that was done. That officer signed to say, the fine print said, and I certify that this was done, done correctly. So the day comes to do the maintenance, and the people are down inside the hull and say, we are ready to take this off. We need authorization to start the work. So the duty officer that day signed for the work package to begin. You may begin work now. You can take apart that valve, the big valve, the big hole, and I certify that with the divers that the blank flange is on. So they started taking apart the valve, and this big guy, fortunately, big sailor, starts moving this thing off, and a lot of water comes in. A lot of water. But for the grace of God and this very large, this is in the mid, late 70s, weightlifting wasn't all that popular. But this was a guy that lifted a lot of weights, thank God. Pushed the thing back in. People were there, and they grabbed and they put these nuts on this thing, and they stopped the flooding, ran some pumps over there. Meanwhile, the whole base was sending over fire trucks, pumps, and everything because some guy went into his walkie-talkie and said, we have flooding on this ship. A lot of water in there. They dewatered it, and it's now time for an investigation. What happened? How can this be? We almost lost a submarine. By the way, that's $750 million in 1977 cost. It's about a $2 billion submarine today. It's time for an accounting of this. So there was an investigation. People gave depositions. Folks met, looked through all the depositions, and they determined that we need to hand down some punishment and some kudos, some awards. So they gave medals to the individuals that basically saved the ship. They gave what's called letters of reprimand. A letter of reprimand to any member of the military, especially an officer, it's a career ender. You are officially reprimanded for performing improperly or, I'll just leave it at that, a violation of behavior, whatever it can be any, but it's a career ender. So the commanding officer of this submarine was brought up to the office of the Commodore, and he's responsible for the whole squadron, and they said, here are letters of reprimand for you to deliver to those two officers. The officer in charge, the day they put this thing on wrong, and the officer in charge who authorized the work and didn't verify that that was on the right spot. So the commanding officer said, I've looked at this, and I don't see how my officers could possibly verify this, and the divers should have done that. I will not accept these letters of reprimand for these officers. I'll take them. I am the commanding officer of the submarine. I am ultimately accountable for whatever goes on in there. These are my officers. You give those letters of reprimand to me. So that was viewed as, well, if you're not going to deliver these like I told you, we're going to go see the admiral. So they went to see the commander of the Pacific Fleet to determine why this commanding officer wouldn't do as told. And he told his story again. The admiral did a review, asked some questions, and said, you know what? He's right. We asked people to do something that we were going to hold them accountable for when actually we didn't have the right processes in place. They have no way of knowing that. I understand the diver's part. So, okay, Captain, I won't punish you or do any administrative action for you, nor these officers. And again, the medals were given out for the right people. So there's this philosophy, and it's been in the naval forces, in all the military, of accountability and responsibility at the highest level, because our commanding officers have a lot of responsibility. So what's become of all of this is a better understanding of what should be, how folks should be accountable and responsible. And this commanding officer, who had the courage to go up and do that, he completed a 30-year career and went on to a successful career in business. So his bravery, really, he thought, this is the end for me. He got that. The two junior officers, one of them left after his required time in the service, and he went on to be a successful businessman in Texas. If he'd had that letter of reprimand, you know, his time out of the Navy, his separation would have been sort of tainted. The other junior officer stayed in the Navy a long time, did a whole career. He did 40 years in the Navy and became the Chief of Naval Operations, because that was me. I was that other guy that, for the grace of God and the courage of this person to give me a second chance through the process, to actually put in place, in the process, a second chance and the means to do it, and by challenging the process, and to be accountable. So I learned a lot from that brave guy.
I love that story. Let's go.
Thank you.
Over to you.
We have some time for questions. Again, if do your best at framing a question as a question and not a comment. But Jim, why don't we start with you?
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Iran. I've been to Iran. I have my own views on the Iran agreement, but I'd like to know what your views are. That's the first part of the question. And the second part of the question is, if Iran decides to withdraw from the agreement and closes the Straits of Hormuz, what does the U.S. Navy do about that?
So I'll go to the second one first. You might, before we got into kind of robust negotiations for the Iran agreement, the JCPOA, Iran threatened to close the straits. And we were, the price of oil was very high then. It's over $100 a barrel. We were very concerned, and we were asked the question, what the hell are you guys going to do about that? The first answer was, how long would it take you to open it? The first answer was 2.5 weeks. Well, try and imagine no oil going through, that's untenable. So we did a lot of work. General Mattis was the central commander at that time. I was in charge of the Navy. We did a lot of work. Bottom line, we can open the straits within a week. We could probably send the big double-hulled tankers that exist. Remember the super tankers? You can fill those hulls, or those tanks, with water, and they're double-hulled, fill the tanks with water, and run them through and go in behind them. So you're kind of a blocker going through there. That can be done almost immediately. So we did a lot of work with the oil industry and the tanking industry, and we looked at our own. So we can open it very quickly, Mr. Ambassador. My thoughts on the deal, I have never looked into the gory details of confirming inspections and all that, but it was designed to deal with the nuclear issue, not the misbehavior of Iran, which is substantial in terrorism, in inciting insurgency, and a whole other misbehavior on the water, which really went down during the negotiations and after the negotiations. And the misbehavior on the water in the straits by Iran is starting to come back a little bit, go figure. But we thought that would happen. I think it was functional for what it was there, for what it was designed for. I think we need to listen for that aspect of it, what it was designed for. 10 years is only 10 years. I fear that we'd blow it off. And the idea was, we got 10 years. We need a longer-term way to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, either kinetically or non-kinetically. And that kind of read cyber or economics, you know. So my view is, it was okay for what it was designed for. I'm glad they got it done, and it just, the administration just didn't muddle along. It certainly improved behavior by Iran and opened the doors for a few other things that they were helpful on, removal of chemical weapons from Syria. Believe it or not, they were a player in that and doing it, even though, who knows, they may have been putting them in here. They are helping us get them out. So that's kind of my view. simply put, in Iran.
Other questions?
It's no surprise with 500,000 people that you're interested in the budget. And I'm wondering what influence or how you influence that process. And in particular, I wonder if you worry about statements like, I'm going to cut taxes and I'm going to simultaneously increase the size of the military, things that are obviously contradictory.
Yes, well, as you say, the vectors don't line up, and it kind of gets to the entitlements. You can do that. You can increase taxes. Just increases the deficit, raises the interest, temporary measure. But that problem with the discretionary programs, not dealing with the entitlements, you're playing with 20 to 30% of all the revenue that you gather with your taxpayers, plus the money that you agree to borrow. You're tweaking 20 to 25, maximum 30% of it. The big elephant in the room is sitting over here. That's what needs to be addressed. In my view, it'll have to come out of a legislative branch. I just don't know that there's any interest, certainly in this administration, to get after entitlements. There might be. I don't know where it is on the list. So that's the key. As a military member, as somebody that represented my budget on the Hill with my secretary, the way to influence it is to get behind closed doors and talk in classified terms with regard to what will be the impact. Tell me about the readiness. What can't you do? When you're testifying in the open, you have to. It's unclassified. It's too vague. Oh, things will be bad. Well, how bad will they be? I can't really talk about, you know, what will happen in the South China Sea. I can't really talk about how long will we be able to deter China, or what missile will be delayed delivering, and why that was a key year to have that sensor, that weapon, that whatever. Unfortunately, if you weren't, you know, nobody wants to testify behind closed doors. There's no public, there's no media. And so you try to get the meetings. To the extent you can get a hold of security committees up there and get their real deep interest, and they have influence like Senator McCain does and some others, it's very difficult if it doesn't come out of the executive branch, out of the White House and the Office of Management and Budget.
We can take one more question.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the U.S.'s long-term strategy to deal with China in the South China Sea region and the Asia region as a large, because at the moment, you know, with the militarization of the South China Sea, China views their biggest problem as the Strait of Malacca, as they import most of their oil via there and they have most of their goods going out of there, and that's somewhat of a choke point. And their strategy right now is to then, you know, pump their oil through the Bay of Bengal, through Myanmar and stuff like that. And the U.S. has enjoyed strategic dominance in that region for so long. If China do solve that problem, you know, I think looking at what their next move might be, which might be, you know, they feel confident enough with their oil being secure enough that they can then put their foot down on things like the U.S. doing Freedom of Navigation Acts in the South China Sea. So what is the, which could also spark a major conflict with the U.S. if the U.S. refused to back down from those Freedom of Navigation Acts. So what is the U.S.'s long-term strategy to deal with that? And what is the likelihood that, you know, China will in the future be strong with the U.S. about what the Seventh Fleet is doing in that region?
Okay.
I know you talked about the fact that the U.S. is trying to make inroads with Singapore and places like that, but if they solve the Strait of Malacca problem, well, then that's kind of really null.
Yes, that's a good observation on your part. I would say that, first of all, the creation of islands on shoals that are nobody's territory because they're shoals. They're below the water level at high tide. And if that's the case, nobody owns that because, well, let me say, you may think you own it, but you don't enjoy in international law the privileges, if you will, of having territorial land. So why is that important? Because China would say, hey, by the way, these features are mine. And Vietnam says, well, some are mine, Taiwan says some are mine, Philippines says some are mine, Malaysia says some are mine, and Indonesia, that's just a sampling of the claims out there. Did I mention Taiwan? So there's a lot of dispute out there. Well, then China builds something on it, and they say, well, it's above sea level. So truly, if you go within this thing I created within 12 miles, you're in my territorial water. We say, no, we're not. And you know that. China, so there's a lot of law-related squawking going on. And we say, in the meantime, we're not recognizing that. And you know why. So this is not really, quote unquote, a dispute or a misunderstanding. Number two, the seaways, if you will, the shortest way between two points to go through the South China Sea, frankly, is not near, and that's a relative term, I'd say it's hundreds of miles, hundreds and hundreds of miles away from these features. That doesn't make Chinese occupation of them and their equipment and their defense equipment and military equipment any less threatening, if you will, but it's not like they're going to have a toll booth there and they can truly interrupt the lines of communication. Should they try to get it, they're kind of cutting off their own foot because they need that trade too. They would have an international brouhaha that would be tremendous. So I just really can't see that anytime in the near future. But here's what we need to do. Make it clear that we're going to be sending ships through this area. We're going to be flying through that area. Do it in a routine enough, but maybe not predictable time frame. Work with China and continue to use the international community to put pressure on them that they're outside the international norm. That doesn't always bother them that much. Because they say, you guys define the international norm, so don't try to fool me. But if it comes from a lot of other nations pushing on them and perhaps applying a little bit of a punishment's not a keyword, but you know what I mean, even if it's a pinprick, it really agitates them and it will tend to define change their behavior. Lastly, good point. How do you prepare for conflict with China? We're not going to run into the South China Sea. We never really were, although some people would say, yeah, we're going to go in there and show them what for. The choke points like Strait of Malacca, China's very aware their oil comes from Hormuz, through Hormuz down there, which, by the way, the Iran question, we say to China, why aren't you guys out here, you know, keeping the strait open? We're almost independent. And they say, well, because you are. That's why we're not out there. Why should we? So we need to look for exactly the kind of things you're talking about. There are more. I can't talk about them in this forum where they need things and we have the means to, if you will, regulate or limit access to it. But they're not unlimited. So the real issue is engage with them to influence their behavior. Non-engagement, anger, punishment because we don't like them, not talking to them. That doesn't work with any nation. It never has. It's really caused issues with our relations with Russia and our interactions. We have no real relations with them other than the incidents, prevention of incidents at sea and the Arctic Council. Thanks, Darren.
Admiral, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Fred.
Good to see you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we heard from former U.S. Navy Admiral Jonathan Greenert, who looked at contemporary security and defense issues across the world. He recently spoke at the 2018 Champlain Institute, hosted by College of the Atlantic. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and James Brooks. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.